This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. How do children learn to talk? Anyone who spent time with young children knows that the answer is both mysterious and mundane. Children seem to magically soak up the language swirling around them and toss it back at you in endearingly unique and often cockeyed forms. My guest, linguist Naomi Barron, says that that apparent ease masks a complex series of neurological, physiological, and behavioral processes, which science is just beginning to uncover. Naomi Barron is a professor of linguistics at American University in Washington, D.C. She's the author of Growing Up with Language, How Children Learn to Talk. She says that the groundwork for language is laid down long before children utter their first word.
The groundwork is the universe around that child, the universe of sounds, of faces, of gestures, of everything that contains communicative intent. From the moment a child is born, there are people talking at it. And only gradually over time do they begin what we might call the conversational duet. Long before anyone is actually saying real words, before the child is saying real words, people are attempting to elicit a smile, a movement, and the child responds, often cooing or later babbling. And all of this input from the surrounding community later turns into words and eventually sentences and conversation.
Anyone who's spent some time around babies has caught them in these marathon monologues, babbling alone in their cribs or wherever. What's the function of babbling and that kind of private speech? What end does it serve?
As best we can tell, babbling is verbal play. It's trying out your articulator, seeing what happens when you put your tongue up against the roof of your mouth and force some air through it. If you listen to kids babble, and some of them do it by themselves and others love an audience, what you find them doing is exploring. And we listen and say, aha, this six-month-old said mama. No, the six-month-old just was playing with putting his or her lips together, opening up the back of the mouth so that the nasal sounds would resonate, and forcing some air out. It's only around age 12 months or so, a little bit before, a little bit after, depending on the child, that you start getting sounds that have meaning.
Let's shift gears a little bit and get right down to brass tacks.
Okay.
Why do most parents talk baby talk to their kids? And does it help kids learn to talk?
My hunch is that the major reason parents use baby talk, and we have to look at what baby talk means, is because it makes the parents feel good. It makes the parents feel good because if you're trying to talk with a 6 or an 8 or 10-month-old or even a 2-year-old, there's very little conversation coming back to you. So you're looking for some way to get connected. In many cases, you have no idea what your child is saying. Your child's looking at you and plaintively saying, duh. Okay, is that dog? Is that daddy? Is that duck? Is that done? You don't know. They all come out as duh. So if you have some way to feel, I'm connected, I'm saying the same sorts of things that my child is. My child's using a much higher pitch speech than I am. I could do that now. My child is saying very little. I could simplify my sentences. My child is saying some things that are ungrammatical. A child might say, more up. And a parent could say in return, yes, I'll give you more up, meaning I'll pick you up again. There's a feeling of connectedness that just doesn't come so easily when you're dealing with someone who doesn't quite look human in many ways yet. Now, does it help? Well, it depends on what aspects of baby talk we're talking about. Baby talk is really a collection of possibilities. And in different cultures, one or another of those items is used. And they're not all used the same in all societies. For example, in much of the world, we use a higher pitch in talking with little children than we do with older people. There are some parts of the world, for example, in Guatemala, where it seems you use lower pitch, because lower pitch is what you use for people of lower status. High pitch is what you use for adults of higher status. So there are other extenuating factors. On the other hand, being ungrammatical because your child is certainly not going to help the language development. But when your child is at the point of knowing how to say it right, that you don't say more up, either you will stop or your child will say, Mommy, no.
Mm-hmm. So what about parents who don't do it? And it seems that more and more people aren't. And I was thinking perhaps as people have children later in life, mm-hmm. They have all sorts of ideas about what's dignified or what's right to do or what's not.
It's interesting. Particular people 30 or 35 and up who are having first children and who are well-educated say, I'll never sound like that in talking with my child. But if you listen to them, you'll find they tend to do a couple of things. First, they tend to slow down their speech. Second, they do tend to use higher intonation patterns. Third, they tend to repeat themselves. A typical characteristic of baby talk is saying the same thing more than once. Why do you do that? Well, how much conversation can you have with a child who's saying either nothing or very little back to you? So repeating yourself to fill the airspace is not such a strange thing. The differences that we're starting to see among older first-time parents, well-educated first-time parents, is they will often introduce new words that were never part of baby talk because they're too sophisticated. I saw a mother the other day at a Starbucks who was explaining to her 2-year-old in a nice, slow baby talk register which coffee was decaffeinated, which coffee and what color the top was, which coffee was French brew. And this kid was just looking, but she was using a teaching register, but with much more sophisticated language. She looked around 40.
Every parent has the requisite Dr. Seuss books or Ogden Nash rhymes or whatever nursery rhymes, nonsense language books and nonsense language play that you engage mm-hmm. in with your children. I know it's wonderful, but I don't know why. Why do children respond so well to it? Why does it stick in our brains so securely and so vividly from our own childhood?
Rhymes are always easier to remember because you have a hook to hang something on. The oral epic poets knew this a long time ago. You can remember things if you have a pattern on which to hook things. And children are no different because you're halfway there. All you have to learn is the beginning sound in the word to get 2 words for the price of one. We know that most children absolutely adore rhymes. The good news is those rhyming abilities can translate into language development. Some very interesting studies have been done at the State University of New York at Stony Brook showing that children who know nursery rhymes, Hickory Dickory Dock and so forth, turn out to become earlier readers than people who didn't grow up on these rhymes. Now, why is that? Because what do you do when you read? You have to look at a word and break it into pieces. You know, if you don't believe in the whole word method of reading, but one that breaks things into sounds, a so-called phonic approach, then if you've already learned cat and mat and rat and sat have something to do with each other, then when you see cat and mat written, you're halfway there because you already know the at part is the same in both the words.
So they have a head start.
Absolutely, they have a head start.
My guest is Naomi Barron. She's a professor of linguistics at the American University in Washington, D.C. She's written a number of books about language and language acquisition. Her most recent book is called Growing Up with Language, How Children Learn to Talk. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with linguist Naomi Barron. Her book about how children learn to talk is called Growing Up with Language. Well, let's talk about some myths. I'd like you to debunk.
Okay. I'll try.
It seems as if the way you're describing language acquisition, it's as if children learn language by talking themselves into it with the help of parents and the incentive mm-hmm. of a social culture. Mm-hmm. But then you hear stories from mothers and fathers. For instance, my child didn't say a word, not a single word, till he was mm-hmm. 4. And then he spoke in full sentences. Mm-hmm. How do you explain either these wide variations among mm-hmm. among kids, or do parents have selective memories?
The parents are probably right. But there are a number of other factors we have to look at. The first is, if the child is developing normally, but doesn't happen to be saying a lot, there could be many reasons for it. First, you want to make sure there's no hearing problem. But if indeed this child, let's say at age 3, suddenly starts putting a bunch of words together, whether it's a full sentence or not, we could look at, and hasn't used a lot of individual words before then, this may be a child who's shy. There are a lot of very shy children who understand a lot of language. How do you know this? You go through a picture dictionary, and you find out when you say, show me the so-and-so, show me the so-and-so. You go through sets of pictures. The dog is kissing the cat. Another one, the cat is kissing the dog, and you ask which is which, and they can understand. There may be many reasons why children are not just prolific talkers, some of which may be related to such things as prematurity. We know that children who were born premature but otherwise healthy tend to be a little slower in all aspects of development, including the development of their articulators. Just the physiology hasn't caught up with that of normal kids yet. So if speaking is a real strain, it doesn't necessarily mean that understanding is. At some point, that praxis seems to be critical, but it doesn't have the same role for everybody.
There's an old joke about Albert Einstein, that he didn't talk until he was 4, and then one day his mother served him some soup, and he said, "Mother, this soup is too hot." And his mother says, Albert, why did you never talk before? And he says, "That is because up until now everything had been quite adequate." And I think that's myth number two, that some children speak late just because they don't want or need to talk.
It's an interesting story. Actually, Albert Einstein himself, in his diaries and letters, doesn't say it quite the same way. There's a letter which I believe he wrote to his sister talking about his own memories of his early language. And he doesn't talk about soup, but he does say he remembers his parents being very concerned about the fact he didn't seem to be talking. And he doesn't remember exactly what age this is, but it seemed to be somewhere around 4 or 5. Now, he also says he felt he was exceedingly fortunate in not codifying the world linguistically, at least in terms of speaking, because he says, I was able to experience things without some set of categories I had to stick things into. Whether this is reading things into his own experiences after the fact, we don't know. Now, we do know that if you don't give children an opportunity to speak, chances are they're going to be slower to develop linguistically. When you look at families where there are 2 or more children of roughly the same age, say a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old or a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old, often it's the older child who steals the floor. And as a result, the younger kids don't have much time to talk, or if they start a sentence, someone else often finishes it for them. And we also know that second-born children, assuming you've got a sibling who's not 10 or 15 years older, tend to be slower in grammatical development, and in fact slower in acquisition of first words than children who are firstborn or only children.
Here's another myth then that you can consider for us. A lot of parents will say, my child walked early and he really, really was interested in running and learning to play with balls and walking upstairs, and he didn't really talk. I don't think he had the brain power to focus on both activities at one time.
His brain is fine. His interest may be non-existent. In the early, say in the first 2 to 3 years of life, there's some families and some cultures that really emphasize verbal communication. There are other cultures that essentially ignore young children. They leave the raising of young children to aunts or to older siblings, and they don't really address a lot of language to kids and don't take children as these things you have to nurture very early on. You have to take care of them, but not really actively nurture them. So you will find some differences across societies, for example, as to when children tend to use their first word. It does differ depending upon, as best we can tell, how much language you address to the child. There also probably are some differences between males and females. And I won't stereotype things and say boys all do this and girls all do this, but on average, boys tend to start talking in the sense of first words and then of putting 2 words together a little bit later than girls. Girls on average are starting to put 2 words together sometime around 18 months. Boys on average, and I'm talking about American society, closer to about 22 months. Is that because physiologically, their articulators are not as developed? That's one possibility. Is that because they're more active and more interested in roaming around? That's another possibility. We don't have a really good answer.
Do you think we talk to boys differently than we talk to girls?
Unfortunately, yes. There's a lot of data now available indicating that, at least in the American society, we talk less to boys as infants than we do to girls. And then as boys start growing, we tend to talk differently with them. Why does this happen? Well, in the early stages, my hunch is we talk less to male infants because they are verbalizing less to us. And our feelings as parents can be hurt just as much as they can as adults in, you know, the adult world. And if you're not talking with me, why should I be talking back with you? We know, for example, that parents of premature children tend not to verbalize to them, you know, when they're in their infant months, because they're not verbalizing back. Interestingly, in some cultures, things flip the other way. There's a wonderful study done in Greece in orphanages looking at the rate of development of language in male children and female children in their infancy and toddlerhood. And it turned out the boys were developing faster than the girls. Well, it also turned out that because of the cultural stereotype of males being important and females being less so, the caretakers were addressing incredibly more language to the male infants than they were to the female infants.
You mentioned earlier articulators, and I assume that means the mouth's ability to articulate different sounds. What makes some sounds hard to pronounce? And why do so many kids say paschetti for spaghetti, as if they had these universal, easier ways to pronounce some words that they all pick up in baby school?
There are really two answers to the question. One has to do with where, how you actually form the individual sounds. You take a sound like p or b. It's pretty clear how you form that sound. You put your lips together, and then you open them up with a breath of air. On the other hand, think about how you make an L, ul. Your tongue is sitting there in Netherland, and it's very hard, because you can't see, if you're a child, what that is looking like. It's hard to know how do you actually form an L or an R, or how do you do things like ch, which takes an awful lot of control over your tongue and just when you release it and how much oomph and air or fricative sound, as we would call it, is going to come out. So that's one problem. Some sounds are just physically easier to see someone else make. The second thing is, if you take a word like spaghetti and you look at how you combine together the sounds, it's a hard word to make, because what you've got to do is flip your tongue back and forth. You start with a s. Okay, that's sort of around where your teeth are, a little bit farther back. Then you've got to move to a p. Then you've got to go all the way in the back of the mouth to where a g is. And then you've got to go back to the middle of the mouth again for a t. And some of these sounds have your vocal cords vibrating. We call them voiced sounds, and some don't. And if you try to do all that together, it's hard. On the other hand, p, that's easy. Sk, you're moving your way back in the mouth. So we have p, sk, t. All kept in the front of the mouth, because you move that k forward a little bit because there's an s sitting there, and we tend to have languages assimilate or come closer together in place of articulation. So it was much easier to produce. And none of that has your vocal cords vibrating for the consonant sounds.
Do you see children's language development and facility changing in any way as our society changes? And I'm thinking that more and more kids are spending more time in daycare centers rather than alone at home with their mother patiently baby talking to them. Has that had any measurable impact on language development?
Well, it's interesting to compare daycare centers with kids raised at home, because we all assume if you're at home with a parent or a full-time caregiver, of course you're going to hear more language. Some studies have been done comparing those kinds of families where the kids are at home with their generally mothers with like socioeconomic grouped children who are in daycare centers. And it turned out that the amount of language directed to the children, both at the daycare centers, but particularly after those kids got home at night, was much greater than the kids who were home all day with their mother or father or caretaker was getting. In part, this may be late 20th century guilt that we haven't seen our kids all day and we just have to talk with them a lot at night. In part, it may be a kind of belief that kids just sort of grow by themselves and they've always for generations been at home and there's nothing special we have to do for them. In part, I strongly suspect, where you have caregivers who are not native speakers of the language of the community, and this is happening increasingly in the United States, the caregiver doesn't talk much. Here was this wonderful opportunity to learn a second language, and there's very little conversation goes on. I go to playgrounds in my neighborhood in Upper Northwest Washington, and you see all these people from very affluent families, children out with their full-time caregiver, and the caregivers are not talking with the children. There is total silence on the playground.
And here parents are thinking their child is getting, I don't know, a special education because or special attention because they're
Indeed.
Home.
Indeed. But you have to plan. You have to think about it. You have to tell your caregiver what you're looking for and to make it happen.
I really enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Naomi Barron's latest book is called Growing Up with Language. Barron is a professor of linguistics at American University. This is Fresh Air.